thing we've noticed in chapters 10 through 18 is not any sort of geographic tracking of the Lord in his journey. We'll see a little bit of that later in chapter 17 when it talks about him getting down into the border of Galilee and the Samaritans. I think that's because we transition into this end of chapter 9, right, with his face fixed to Jerusalem. And so the teachings now involve a lot more confrontation with the Pharisees and the lawyers, the religious authorities, one, so we see that, and also much more teachings to his disciples about how they're to live, how they're to teach, beginning that preparation for when he's going to go away, which we saw in one of his parables, right, when he's telling them about how they need to be when the Son of Man returns, right, with that parable of the master leaves, preparing them for him to go away. And so I think one point that we can take from that is these are to be sort of universal instructions, right? The fact that they aren't particular to a particular place means they are for all his disciples for all time, much like the Sermon on the Mount is, these general declarations of how disciples are to live. So, you know, for example, we saw him go back to his hometown and he's rejected and he says, well, a prophet is, you know, it's not without honor except in his own town. And that we might think, well, that's him telling those doggone Nazarenes they better shape up. So we don't see any particularized teachings that we might say are for this particular group of people. Even his criticisms of the scribes and Pharisees are, at least in my view, phrased in a way that's going to the spirit that is behind it, not their particular office. Maybe their office and their prestige is why they had that spirit. But there is, I think, even more general application to those teachings. So getting into Luke 14, this first event we see is Jesus again on the Sabbath and healing on the Sabbath, and we've seen that, saw that in Luke 13, right? And we also saw that in Luke 6. And he's in again in the home, the house of the ruler of the Pharisees. So with someone of position and authority, right? And it reads, one Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, as lawyers again, doggone lawyers, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, which of you having a son or an ox that is falling into a well on a Sabbath day will not immediately pull him out? And they could not reply to these things. So a lot, and we saw this in Luke 13, right, where he heals a woman who is suffering this physical ailment, and the ruler of the synagogue says, there are 6 days of the week where you can come be healed. Come back on one of those days. Don't, you know, work on the Sabbath. You go back and look at Exodus 20, and that's the first place where we see this command about that God gave the Israelites the Sabbath, and they're to honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, meaning set apart, right? And they're not to work on that day. You look at that Hebrew word, and of course, like a number of Hebrew words, a number of Greek words, when you try to put them into English, they have multiple definitions because of how they were used. But the principal definition of this word means occupation or work or business. And if you look at the incidents, at least the violations of the Sabbath, right, there were things like going out and gathering firewood, just kind of a common piece of work. God, of course, told them, right, on the day prior to the Sabbath, gather twice the manna, and he would miraculously preserve it for the Sabbath. That's the only day of the week, right, where the manna was preserved, because otherwise it would spoil. So that's the sorts of incidents we would see. But that's not what Jesus is doing, right? That's not what we saw him do on Luke 6. That's not what we saw him do last week in Luke 13. He's healing. So, and in particular, last week, Luke 13, right, he says, this daughter of Abraham, should she not be freed from this ailment? And he almost makes it sound like, right, that it's some external force on her. But his point is, should this daughter of Abraham not be freed of this suffering that she's had? So was healing those in need the work God intended in Exodus 20 when he said, don't work? Maybe this is a leading question. I don't even show I'm a lawyer, right? Yeah, no, that it's not. I mean, you look at that, it is the way I would explain it. He was, remember, Mark 2, when Jesus is explaining why these things that were done on the Sabbath were acceptable, God made the Sabbath for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the purpose of the Sabbath, right, was that man could be taken out of the everyday drudgery of life. The stress is associated with it, the exertions associated with it, that you have to distract yourself from fellowship with God to think about, oh, I gotta gather firewood, and then we gotta bake the bread, and gotta go tend to the sheep, herd them. All of those things that distract us and take our time away. And what God was actually telling them is all of these things, you know, you might think, because you're good at it or creates wealth, that these are good things. They actually just take you away from me. They burden you. These are stresses in your life. Yes, you can't avoid them, but I'm going to give you one day when you're free of all of those things that take you away from fellowship with me, right? So the Sabbath was for man. It was to be a blessing to the Israelites, not a burden. The other thing we see, for example, from Luke 6, where Jesus is telling John's disciples, that, you know, they come, are you the one we seek, or do we seek another? And Jesus, as the various revelations that the Savior has come, recounts how the blind see and the deaf are allowed to heal. Well, those, of course, are all sorts of healings, different from the one we see in Luke 14. But those are proofs of the Messiah coming. And why is that? Well, John 9, right? When the rulers of the temple are confronted the man who was born blind, who Jesus healed, and they're saying, well, who is this man? And do you believe in him? He said, well, I'm not sure who he is, but I do know that no one can heal the blind unless he comes from God, because only God has the power to heal the blind. So these healings were miracles that God was giving the Israelites as proof of who Jesus is. They all came from God. Obviously, work that can only be done by the power of God doesn't violate God's purpose on the Sabbath. So, and yet, you know, that's the Pharisees again and again and again challenged Jesus about that. And in these different incidents, he's explaining them, this is what the Sabbath was. And of course, also saying who he is, right? Luke 6, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So, but I guess the point for us from this, it's not like Jesus is changing the Sabbath. He's not overruling the Sabbath laws. This isn't the theological term antinomianism, right? That he's against the law and he's making exceptions to the law. He's showing them what the law actually was. And so acts of mercy, acts of that, you know, fall under that heading, right? Two greatest commandments. First, to love God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength. And then second, to love your neighbor as yourself. this act of healing is an example of loving your neighbor. So those things that fulfill God's commands didn't violate the Sabbath at any point. So, a lot of talking by me. Sorry about that. He's definitely challenging the Pharisees' thinking, right? So, but not just theirs. I think it can apply today. So what challenge their thinking do you think he was making? Yes, Anthony.
On a small detail is that he is invited to the leader of the Pharisees' home. And right. There's a piece of my twisted brain that goes, where they set him up and that they made sure the man who has the dropsy was there just by way of means to go, let's see what he's going to do. Because clearly if he's invited, they know he's coming. And it's in the text that says he's going to be on the Sabbath to go and break bread and have a meal with him. And so you go, they're always trying to figure out a way to expose him, or I should say at this point, he's got enough popularity that they keep that on their watch list.
Yes, that they were watching him closely, right? And maybe because of these prior incidents, said, oh, go get someone who needs, invite someone who's healing. This man probably wasn't even in on it, right? They just said, well, Jesus will be here. Remember, he heals people. Why don't you come? That could be. He then says to them, well, which of you who, if you had an ox, and the ESV says, son, that's easy to see. Your version may not say son. That's not really the point. Wouldn't take him out, and yet, you're not merciful to this man. And you're saying I'm violent. But if you look at Deuteronomy 22:4, God commanded them to do just that. If you come upon your brother, your fellow Israelites, mule, ox, it's in distress, you help him take it out. It doesn't say except on the Sabbath day. Right? You're to do that at all times. So there were commands given that weren't limited to be performed on the Sabbath day because they were, in essence, I guess we say, acts of mercy, right? Acts of love and charity to others. So what the, so it was right that they would do that. I mean, he wasn't saying, well, you would do that and you're a hypocrite for doing that because you only care about your ox. I mean, maybe that is why they were willing to do that, but his point is, you fulfill the command here, but you're not fulfilling the command there, right? So, inconsistency, right? Maybe there's a personal motive for why they were inconsistent on this. Yes, Tony. Yeah, where would that inconsistency come from except right, from our heart and then out? Not accepting the whole counsel of God, so to speak. Right. For them, maybe there's various reasons. Obviously, gives them control over the people to have this host of rules, reinforces their power. Maybe that's it. We're never really told why they have all of these rules that seem inconsistent, and Jesus is constantly pointing out these inconsistencies. Maybe that's one. But what it does illustrate is, we can't let personal preference be what determines the commands we will obey. Right? Whether it's because we benefit from not obeying them or obeying them. I got to get my ox out of the ditch. Don't want to lose that ox. But at the same time, I want to make sure that everyone, jumps when I say jump on the Sabbath day. Right? Because maybe that's it. And there's obviously equivalence today. There are things where obeying God might give us, you know, maybe it's easier, maybe it just fits with what we think it should mean to be Christian, and other things we don't. So, you know, we need to have hearts that let God direct us, right? Romans 12, 1 through 2, that's the work of the Spirit in us. Spirit is continually trying to conform us to the will of God through the Scripture, showing us how we can prove what is the good and acceptable will of God, and also have spirits to do whatever's revealed. And so, you know, at least in my mind, that's one of the things we continue to see with the Pharisees. You know, it's easy to just sort of put them in this unique category that has no application to us. But really, they're picking and choosing the things they want to obey based on how it benefits them, or perhaps fits with their perception of who ought to be part of God's people. Right? Samaritans out, Gentiles out, you know, lax Jews out, maybe. But that kind of attitude, I think is easy to have today, too. Yes, Anthony.
Well, I like to give them, you made the application about the Pharisees, and then go, where do we fit in this? Are we quick to follow and admonish one another, confess sins to one another, you know, 95 different verses of one another? We pick and choose what's easy and convenient for us. Now we have application to go, okay, this is that one, but that one. Thank you so much.
And I think it's easy to do that, and you know, we also like to look at the Pharisees and say, well, they taught traditions not found in Scripture. Absolutely true, and maybe some did it for out of malice or ill motive, but some maybe just did it because this had been present for so many generations. It's what they knew, and it almost became unconscious for them to do it, because, you know, the people followed them. They were the ones who that were most popular with the people. And, you know, so it's easy, even as to traditions, that they just are, and we're used to them, and they're familiar, and it's not even a conscious thing that we're choosing to follow them. But, you know, I think that is it, that danger of allowing, you know, what we want to obey, what is suitable maybe by personality or personal circumstance, not just there's some transaction to it. I mean, probably giving that implication. But, you know, there's a variety of reasons why there might be parts we want and parts we don't want to focus on. And I think, you know, all of us have that. Moving on to 6 through 11, Jesus gives this parable of the wedding feast, right? And I'll summarize it because I've been chewing up a lot of time. It's the parable, right, where this host invites first a group of people, all of whom have a reason to not come, right? And I'm sorry. The wedding feast. I'm looking at the next one. Sorry. Parable of the wedding feast. You go in, you take a high place, and then you get moved down, right? And Jesus concludes it that when you are invited, go and sit in the lower place so that when your host comes, he may move you higher. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So, who does the proud person exalt himself against? I mean, some is the other guests, right? You go in and take that prime spot. Yes, ultimately the host, right? So, you know, it is a parable, but ultimately it's the host. And really, pride is against God, right? Even if it's expressed, I mean, in the sense of I'm being proud towards, you know, God. God rejects the proud, gives grace to the humble. Now, it shows itself by being prideful against others, but they're, of course, made in the image of God. So we're proud in our own minds, pride expressed towards others, but even though it's expressed toward others, it's ultimately directed towards God because we're rejecting His what He reveals to us about ourselves, which I think then takes us to the next question, right? So Jesus, in this familiar James 4, of course, says something similar where, so Jesus concludes it, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, he who humbles himself will be exalted. So the point being, humility is vital for our fellowship with God. So why is humility so important to faithfulness and fellowship? Right. As James also said, right, every good and perfect gift comes down from the above, from the Father of lights. If we know who we actually are before God, how can we be prideful? Right? You look at first 11 verses of Romans 5, how can we be prideful before God when we were His enemies, when He sent His Son to redeem us? Right? How, so if we're proud, right, we're really lying about ourselves in terms of who we are before God. And if we don't recognize who we are before God, are we going to respond to God the way He desires? That's a rhetorical question. Sorry, Anthony. Right. Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. The idea of, you know, presenting yourself as something you're not, wearing a mask and then I think from a practical standpoint, you see it in just this parable about the wedding feast, right? So this prideful person separates himself from the other guests by taking this place of honor, and certainly if we have pride, we're not going to be able to fulfill the purpose of our theme this year, right? Proclaiming Jesus to all nations. Because if you're proud, you're necessarily separating yourself from other people. I don't share your condition before God because of who I am. And, I suppose we see that with the Pharisees, right? When Simon invites Jesus to his home and this penitent woman comes and she's prostrating herself before Jesus and doing these acts of acceptance and humility before Jesus, and Simon says, well, if he was actually a prophet, he wouldn't let that sinner woman even touch him, right? So we're not going to fulfill the purpose of sharing the gospel if we're proud, because we're going to separate ourselves from other people. I'm not... like later, right? We'll see the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee both praying in the temple, right? I'm glad I'm not like this tax collector. And so you know, ultimately we're not in any different condition before God than any other person, except to the extent, right, that God has blessed us and set us apart through salvation by Jesus, through the atoning sacrifice of Jesus, and through the sanctification of the Spirit. In other words, nothing that comes from us and nothing that any other person can't also receive by faith in Jesus. Yes, Sister Trine. Yep. Yep, very good. And that also takes us back to up here, right? That we're not going to receive the full counsel of God if we have prideful hearts. If we have humble hearts, then we're going to accept God's instructions even when, you know, it's difficult and directed towards things where we need to change, which also, right, is what we see in Romans 12, 1 and 2, is that we're being transformed, changed, and conformed to the will of God. That's not necessarily a comfortable experience. All right, so let's move into chapter 12 through 24. This is the parable of the great banquet, so I wanted to jump ahead because I'm using up too much time, probably. Anyway, so I'll summarize this one as well. So he begins with this sort of general instruction. If you give a great banquet, don't invite all your sort of wealthy, prosperous friends. Invite those in need who can't sort of reciprocate to you, who can't then give you a feast of honor in the same way. And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Verse 14. And then he gives this, he then introduces, blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. So, and then gives this parable of the great banquet. So the parable of the great banquet is really about the kingdom and being in the kingdom, as opposed to this introductory instruction where he's really continuing this teaching of humility, I think, that we've seen so far in the chapter. And he gives this parable where a man gives a great banquet, sends his servants out to invite people. The first people who he invites maybe are in that first category, right, where Jesus said, well, don't invite those people who are themselves prosperous. Right, and they all decline for various reasons. Right, one is that I bought a field and I must go see it. Another is I've just got married and I need, you know, it's the time where I need to be with my wife, for example. And then the master gets angry, sends his servants essentially out. Right, just go out to the highways and byways. I love that phrase. Just because I don't know what a byway is, but it sounds good. And invite in whomever will come, right, in essence. And all of these people who are not who you would think, the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. And they do that, and there's still more room, and the master sends them out. Then go invite more until my house is full. So that's in essence what it is about, those who invite and reject, and then how just the whole, range of people are invited and accept and fill the house of the master. So what does this parable tell us about God's desire for people to enter his kingdom? Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that takes us to the next. Let's just segue right into that, because that's right. So, I mean, in terms of the parable, right, all the people who wind up being invited and come are not, I think implicitly, these are not the people who you would have invited had the people who were initially invited come, right? Okay. But there's teachings here, I think, about God's attitude. That's right. It's for all, regardless of how people are perceived by other people, right? And regardless of their condition, he wants his kingdom filled with all who will accept the invitation. Doesn't matter what their condition is. And you know, this, I think, is a continuing point we see in these various teachings. Sometimes it's expressed, like here. Others, it's implicit. That when he says the attitude you need to have is to accept what I've revealed and what the commands of God are, well, then that means everyone can do that, right? So it's not, you know, something limited to the Pharisees. Okay, so you look at who accepts and who declines. What attitudes first does this parable warn us about among the people who refused it, who had reasons not to come? Hey? Oh, that one's even worse. Sorry. Okay. Excuses to reject. Might be good ones, right? Well, they seem to become increasingly more understandable, right? The first one is, well, I just bought a land. Oh, well, the land will be there, dude. What are you doing? Just go and look at your land afterwards. But then it's, well, I just got married. Oh, well, I can see where you might need, because we have rules about how married couples are supposed to spend time. So I can see that. And then, oh, my parents, right? So they become increasingly, like, to the human mind, more understandable reasons. But the master, right, views them all the same way, that it's still rejected. And right, they came up with a reason. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Wade. Right.
Understand the Sabbath because you're all here for the wrong reason.
Right. I mean, that, right, this is a ruler of the temple, so if he invites you, well, you definitely go for that. Well, it's not a ruler. You know, I do need to go look at that field, so maybe I won't go because there's not as much benefit for me in that. And I look at this, and I can't help but think of the parable of the soils, right? There's different reasons why. I mean, I just bought land. Well, that's a pretty lame reason. I mean, the land will be there. But you just married. Oh, well, it's a little more on this. And right, the point of soils, some of it is just hard. Seed didn't take root at all. Others, shallow, and just couldn't take the burning heat. And then others, the thorn, you know, weeds and thorns grew up and entangled it. And there's sort of different circumstances affecting each of these people's decisions not to come, but they still, you know, as Jeff said, they ultimately didn't want to come. Other things, whatever it was, became more important. And part of this is there'll always be something that can be an excuse if you don't want to come. Right? Yes, sir. Yes, brother. Yep. Yeah, that's a great point and kind of a sobering point, right? That goes back to Jennifer mentioned how, you know, we live in a very prosperous society. What you see here is people who had those things became more important because they didn't have sufficient need to come, right? So that's kind of sobering. The people who came were the people who like had nothing that they could point to as an excuse or to be sufficient in the world compared to being invited to the banquet. Yes, Sister Trinette. Yeah. Right. So when he says at the end, every one of you cannot renounce all that he has, cannot be my disciple. I mean, that's what those who rejected him, right, were all doing. They all had things that were of greater worth and value than to the invitation of the Master. And, you know, renouncing isn't necessarily giving up. It just, it means, well, I mean, might be giving it up because of the need. But it's really, it's a sort of a statement of attitude and spirit that you renounce these. They are not of importance compared to being a disciple of Christ. And
I think, to Sister Trinae's point,
that it could be material things. That's what we normally think of as all that he has. You know, if you don't renounce all that you have, we always think material goods. But it could be just a condition of your life that could otherwise create an impediment to being willing to follow Christ, some difficulty of life, some physical ailment that we might have. And we need to be able to, you know, to renounce any of those excuses, because that's what we see the people who came to the feast do. Right? They had things. Sister Sinead's right. They all had good excuses, better excuses than the people who didn't come. And yet those things that they had, they renounced them in that sense. They weren't freed of them, but they renounced them in the sense of impeding their willingness to come and follow the Master. And so, you know, whatever it might be that we have, we need to be willing to renounce that, and we can follow Jesus. And, you know, that could be any number of things. I can't even list those. There can be things that I've never experienced, can't understand the challenges associated with renouncing them. But we all need to be able to do that. And then finally, this statement about what salt is good for, right? Good salt and worthless salt. And what expectation does Jesus set in that statement for his disciples?
I guess, you know, broadly I would say, right, that we have to be people who can fulfill his purpose, right? He's
given us the seasoning. To the extent that we can be an influence for purity, it's because he's purified us, right? And we need to live lives where we continue to have that distinctiveness that he's given us. And that's why he concludes this with, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Right? We need to continually be the kind of people who are humble, seeking to know his will, to learn his will, to be conformed to his will, study and prayer, in the influence of other Christians who are themselves salt and light, right? We're first salt and light to each other, and then together salt and light by going out to the world. And we're not going to fulfill his purpose and his purpose for our lives if we don't have that, right? If we let all of these cares and concerns of the world that we've seen him, use in these various parables, not just in Luke 14, but up to this point, diminish that, entangle our hearts, distract our hearts and our minds to where what people see is just us being tied down by the ordinary, common things of life that. Again, go back to the Sabbath, right? We're supposed to be free of all those. God wants us to be free of those so that we can have fellowship with him. Yes, Anthony, and then we'll ring the bell.
And we can become things that like it and mean it.
Good point. Thank you very much. Bernie, if you'd ring the bell, please. Thanks very much. We'll study Luke 15 next week.